Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back a great guest co-host, Dr. Bob Gwaither. Welcome back, Bob.
Thanks, Adam. It's good to be here.
You know, we have a treat today because we're going to be talking with Dr. Jamila Battle about her new book, From Abuse to Abundance, How Trauma Can Hold You Back. And I know you were one of Dr. Battle's mentors in medical school.
That's true, for a long time.
Yeah, so this is really special and looking forward to that conversation. But first, we've got some research that matters. And our very first one, just diving right in, is about schizophrenia, which is such a difficult condition. It affects like 1% of the world's population. Treatments are oftentimes antipsychotics. And this is research looking at, is there a way to treat it with vitamins?
And it turns out there is. High-dose vitamin B complex, including vitamin B6, B8, and B12 can significantly reduce the symptoms in schizophrenia compared to standard treatments. And, you know, we've got a lot of atypical antipsychotics now that are out there. We've done the best we can, but this is still a devastating disease. And finding something as innocuous as vitamins that can really help out seems to be a really good finding.
And this was actually published in the journal Psychological Medicine, and it's one of those types of studies called a meta-analysis. They put together a whole bunch of other studies where it may have been more difficult to find a result in any one study, but when they put them all together, they can perhaps see impact. And so there are 18 clinical trials with 832 patients, and those who got these B vitamin drugs at higher doses, perhaps combined with other vitamins, seem to have reductions in psychiatric symptoms. I was a little concerned, Bob, that there were only 832 patients in 18 clinical studies. I was like, I would like to have seen this in thousands of patients to get a better sense of how much is the benefit. And we do know that while most vitamins taken in excess are harmless, you put them out in the urine, some medications at high doses can cause symptoms. And so I was a little worried that, you know, would we people, if some is good, might take too much. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think that meds can certainly have adverse consequences when used in high dose, but they didn't report much of that in this article. And it seems to me that 832 people in these studies were treated and followed. I sort of think it's going to be a good outcome. I'm not worried about the side effects of the vitamins.
Yeah, I think one of the keys would be to actually talk with the doctor treating for the schizophrenia so they know that you may be taking high-dose vitamins. They could see if there are any drug interactions with the pharmacist to make sure that there are not, and to recognize that it's still probably early in its development and more research is needed, but it may be an option, certainly. Let's talk about our very next research that matters and talk about kind of the downside sometimes of screening. We don't sometimes think about, you know, we ask people to be screened for a colonoscopy to prevent colon cancer, to be screened with a mammogram to prevent breast cancer. And we don't think about, well, what happens if you have a false positive? The test looks like it's positive, but it turns out not to be true.
So this was a very large study, looked at 650,000 negative mammograms from 261,000 women. But they also looked at 90,000 false positives, meaning that the test came back positive. And they did something typically to rule it out. Could be just another view on the screen, but it could also be an invasive biopsy, whatever. And what they found was that the women who had the false positives were later coming back for their continuation of screenings to prevent late-stage breast cancer. And unfortunately, there was a little higher incidence of breast cancer that had metastasized when they did have a look at these people who had a false positive.
And so they came back later in general than the women who had a true negative. Though, honestly, that's not really all that surprising. You know, I was actually shocked, Bob, that of 261,000 women, almost 100,000 had a false positive test. That suggests that, you know, one out of three women who's going undergoing mammography screening over a long enough period of time, at least in this particular study, could have had a false positive. That alone is, I think, calls for concern. Now, that doesn't mean that women shouldn't have it. That's an individual decision, clearly. We have guidelines for this. But I think we have to recognize that there are downsides to some screening tests.
Yes, especially psychological ones, because people who've gone in there, done this test, had them tell it, no, it's not right, that's a possible kind of traumatic memory for them.
Yep. And primary prevention is always good. Ways of reducing the risk of breast cancer by exercise, not smoking, losing weight, and not drinking excessive alcohol. Let's talk about our next research that matters. And this is about technology for those with heart failure, which we know is a major cause of death and causing people to go into the hospitals. And this is to ask, well, could you diagnose someone who's going to have a flare of their heart failure earlier so that you get them treated earlier?
And this is done by Marjorie Subic and Marilyn Rantz, who are both professors and researchers in the Sinclair School of Nursing. And essentially, they're looking for ways to monitor people at home or even in a nursing home and keep them out of a higher-priced hospital. And they found that they could, with their engineering expertise, have these little tubes that they keep around the patient, in this case, lying under the mattress that the patient's lying on, so it doesn't encumber the patient at all. And they were able to detect exacerbation of congestive heart failure up to 2 weeks in advance so that they could treat it in the facility and not have to send somebody to an inpatient setting.
You know, I think this is good research. I'm not so certain it's ready for prime time yet, how you make these sensors, what are the costs of these sensors. There's an old reliable way that's really low cost, low tech, that really works pretty well for a lot of people, not everyone, which is to monitor your daily weight and to talk with your doctor and learn that when your weight begins to change, that's oftentimes a very early clue. But I do like the idea that they're developing tests that can maybe diagnose it earlier, because that clearly is the best way of preventing it from getting worse. Let's talk about our very last research that matters. And this is the taking of multiple medications, oftentimes that affect the brain, by people who are getting older.
And they're really looking carefully at opioid painkillers, antidepressants, tranquilizers, and antipsychotic drugs, all of which can affect the brain. And there's a large number of people who take something from all three of those categories every day.
You know, and it's actually worse than this, Bob, because we both know, you know, patients who may be on a medication like an SSRI, things like Prozac or Zoloft, people who may be on what's called a benzodiazepine, like Ativan or Klonopin, these drugs that kind of are sedating. And then they may also be on Benadryl or an antihistamine. I don't even talk about the people on pain medications. And when you combine two or three of these, a lot of elderly, it could really have adverse effects on their health.
And the largest problem was seen in rural areas. It doubled for all the older folks, the prescription of these things together, but it tripled in the rural areas. Important among the considerations here are using opioid pain medications with anything else that depresses respirations, because it's clearly associated with early death.
You know, I think our take home is we know that these things occur if you're on multiple medications that can be affecting the brain, as many medications do. Encourage you to talk with your doctor. See if you can get on less. See if you can find a non-drug alternative to help with sleep, a non-drug alternative to help with pain, a non-drug alternative to help with anxiety or depression, if at all possible. Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. Bob, we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Jamila Battle about her new book, From Abuse to Abundance, and how to address trauma that can hold you back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Guyther. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. A presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Guyther. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. Jamila Battle about her book, From Abuse to Abundance, and how to address trauma that can hold you back.
Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Battle.
Thank you.
You know, we usually start a show with asking our guests to tell us a little bit about themselves, and you've requested to read something about yourself from your book, Abuse to Abundance. And I'll tell our listeners that this is going to be a very powerful interview and hope they'll put down whatever they're doing and just listen for a couple minutes. Dr. Battle.
All right. So I'm going to read a couple paragraphs from the prologue of my book, From Abuse to Abundance. It's the dog days of summer. The year is 1991. I am 14 and having fun sitting at a table getting ready to play the game of Monopoly with my mother and two younger siblings. Taking a welcome break from reading my dictionary, our family dog, my inseparable companion, lies at my side. The house smells of Mama's salmon eggs and grits, and Daddy's music plays in the background, competing with the whirl of the fan, a poor substitute for the broken air conditioner. The vibe is lazy because we are starting the day free from fear and pain. I have the car, I exclaimed, sweat beating on my face as I hold up the small silver token. Let's play the long version, my brother says. Sure, why not? All we have right now is time and space, and everyone is safe for now. For that, I am grateful. The sound of tires rolling onto the unpaved driveway interrupts our bliss. Oh no, Daddy's here. Instantly, my thoughts turn to fear, and I can see the same reaction on my mom and siblings' face. Hurry, Mama says. Turn the music off. Put the game away. The keys rattle and the door opens.
Wow. You know, listening to this, it goes from an opening that sounds familiar and sounds full of family to one that sounds really frightening.
Yes.
Why was it frightening?
It was frightening because my dad had a problem with addiction. And as you all know, addiction is quite common in this country and across the globe. He was also a very charismatic jazz musician, and everyone loved him. And in fact, we looked like a perfect family on the outside, but on the inside, literally, we lived in like a prison. And so there were bars on the windows, and the phones were tapped, and we shared our house with rats and bats. And it wasn't uncommon for me to be bound to duct tape, beaten with wire, for my dad to torture us with the rodents in the house. And this was his way of taking out his pain and his frustrations on our family, fueled by drug addiction.
Thank you for sharing that beginning prologue with us.
You're welcome.
Well, Dr. Battle, you've certainly turned your life around from those days. And I know it was an amazing journey. And you've written a book about it called From Abuse to Abundance. And it's your personal story. And it's both harrowing and sad and scary, but it's also triumphant and inspiring. Tell us a little bit about your story and how it led to the book.
Mm-hmm. So with me, I came out always being curious and really just a learner. And so I had a value very young at age of wanting to be happy. And when I read about happiness and I fact-checked it against my reality, there was a discrepancy. And I was very curious about why, and I wasn't happy with that current state. And so I started asking myself powerful questions. And these questions stirred a lot of curiosity. Unfortunately, some of those questions caused more beatings. And, you know, being the oldest, I was also very protective of my family. But I'm very blessed and completely overjoyed that I never lost that curiosity. And that's really what saved my life and my family.
I know we want to know more about how did you move from this state of fear and intimidation and abuse to one in which you are in medical school and you're on your path to becoming a successful and accomplished and triple board certified physician. Where did you get support? Mm-hmm. Who was there for you, and how did that play out? Did that have an impact for you?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I tell you, when you're on the brink of life or death, it really can cause you to act. And so one day when my dad fired a partially loaded gun to my head on an empty chamber, I said, enough is enough. I'm tired. It's time to act. During my journey, I discovered resiliency, which it's all around us. It's the ability to be flexible, adaptive, open-minded, to ask, what if? And my question all along was, what if it could be different? What if it was possible to be safe? What could I achieve if I were simply safe? Intuitively, I just knew safety was the first step. And now in my work, I have discovered that it is actually safety before we can tap into a resiliency and change. But along the way, once I cried out for help and I went into foster care system, initially there were shaky homes and there were some toxic environments, but the one saving grace was the school that I was going to, and there I could be safe. There I had teachers who cared about me and were able to provide feedback so that I could learn the importance of values and self-efficacy, so I could see results and boost confidence. And those are the type of protective factors, a nurturing adult, just one, self-confidence, self-efficacy, that helped to build that resilience.
We're talking with Dr. Jamila Battle, author of a new book, From Abuse to Abundance, family doctor, addiction specialist, sleep specialist. How did you get first interested in medicine?
A great question. So for me, one of my mentors was my pediatrician, and I also had a talent for biological sciences. And so I looked at, how can I apply this talent and this interest, this passion that I have? And it was back then, because I was exposed to my pediatrician, a physician, or research. And how could I integrate the both of those pieces? And so I think just being really, interested in the human body and the entire ecosystem and how that plays, and combining that with the science talent or gift that I had, was really what fueled the desire to become a physician.
Well, we're really grateful for that.
You know, you title this book From Abuse to Abundance, which is sort of like where you came from and where you wound up, but then you subtitle it. You've got this thing on here that says, Reboot Your Soul, Repair Your Heart, Rebirth into Prosperity. And I know you've used those three concepts, reboot, repair, and rebirth, to do other things in your life which you now engage in to help people who are lost along the way or abused or in addiction.
Yes. Reboot, repair, rebirth came to me when I was meditating. And oftentimes, answers come to us that guide us onto our purpose when we're silent. And reboot, to me, refers to like a start over. Realizing that you're hurting, being honest. Often in addiction and in the addiction practice, the first step is really being honest that you're hurting, being honest that you're addicted to a substance or a behavior. And really, when you look at awareness, it shifts to the problem at hand when you're honest. And then the next step is reorganization, and that has to do with change. So helping patients find their why and then laying out a strategy on how they can either move from the hurting or become sober, how they can really take control of their life and gain control of overwhelming symptoms. And then rebirth is created after all the hard work of repair. Then we have rebirth, which is kind of a state of, you know, the importance of you being integrated back into a whole centered being who's able to share and give back.
Well, we appreciate you opening some doors here. We're walking through them. You're coming with us. But we do need to take a short break. When we return, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Jamila Battle about her amazing book, From Abuse to Abundance, and How to Address Trauma That Can Hold You Back. We'll be right back with your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Wagner. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. We've been talking with Dr. Jamila Battle about her book, From Abuse to Abundance, and How to Address Trauma That Can Hold You Back. To put it all on the table, Dr. Battle, we have to acknowledge that we know each other pretty well because you were one of my good advisees for a long time. But really, when you came to this area, you started at Duke, and you managed to get in there to undergraduate school in Duke after some things in Tennessee that were difficult.
Yes, that's correct. One of the things that saved me was the tenacity to hold on to what my value and goals were. And to do that, I knew I needed to get away from Tennessee. Was really blessed with a college tour that my high school put on, and I identified Duke as a school that was a good fit. And one day I called Duke up and I said, get me there early. You know, I need to have a reboot, essentially. I wasn't safe. And as fact, I was homeless. And I called and said, give me a reason to come and I'll be there, and brought a bus ticket and got to Duke about a month early and started a project build program where I was volunteering. And so even getting into Duke, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, but then to get to Duke was a challenge.
And then to Carolina as a starting medical student. Married yet?
Married before starting medical school.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a child during medical school.
Yes.
Most of us are just trying to actually get past the biochem test. You got a few other things going on in your life.
Exactly. And so Abria, our first child, was our first year of medical school. And UNC School of Medicine offered the choice to slow down a bit. And so that, you know, definitely was a part of the journey that really helped me to create abundance, because it's not a race. I knew I had some other responsibilities and priorities, including even how to be an effective parent, because I had not had one. So I had to take some class on effective parenting. But understanding, too, that trauma can be passed down. Trauma affects the development of your child's brain. And so being in medical school, understanding the importance of environment, is when I elected to slow down so that I could balance being a parent, a good mother, and still be an effective medical student.
And you've gone on to have two more children.
Yes.
They're all with AU, which I love the we know that's the symbol for gold.
Yes.
And interesting enough, all my siblings, our parents named us all with the letter A. So I certainly love that. How's that like, being a mother of three and all the balance and doing so many different things that are so amazing?
Oh, my goodness. They are the apple of my eye. So there's Autumn. She was born at Michigan, where I did my training. And then Austin, who was born recently. And they all, if you noticed, start with AU. I was very passionate about the periodic table and the AU symbol, meaning gold. And to keep balance, I have to be flexible. I have to create really with intention what balance looks like, because that could really truly cause a lot of imbalance. Three children, a working mom, board certified physician in three areas. And so to move from victim to survivor to creator, really it's about understanding your values and then really aligning your action with intention. And so part of the plan was, my husband is a stay-at-home dad, and that's a big piece to helping with proper work-life balance.
And, you know, I know that all the time you're doing this at Duke and UNC, your family wasn't doing all that well, except for you. I mean, you were doing remarkably well, but, and so you had that burden on your shoulders at some level, too.
Exactly. I recall one rotation. In fact, my mom had come down homeless, nowhere to go. She had, at this point, was addicted to drugs as well, and she found the drugs. She was trying to get away from the drugs, but found them here and relapsed and was in the ER with hypertensive emergency. And I happened to be the one on call that night. But with compassion, I had an attending physician who was very compassionate, who sent me home. And it helped me, I think, just kind of realize, you know what, this is what addiction looks like. This is a chronic disease. Had I not been in medical school, I think that I really would have felt like, what's wrong? I don't understand. You know, this is embarrassing. But I was able to use the knowledge and have compassion about the situation, but also healthy boundaries, which I actually learned, Dr. Gwaither, from you, the importance of having healthy boundaries so that we can continue to do good work and be compassionate and empathetic to our patients and ourselves.
We're talking with Dr. Jamila Battle, author of From Abuse to Abundance. And Dr. Battle, I can't help but think that spirituality has to play some role. And I'm wondering if you might discuss for our listeners how you incorporate that into your life and what recommendations you have in your book for those who really are suffering.
So, three things for youth who are suffering: realizing it's not your fault and not getting in the middle of the fighting, because I often got in the middle of the fighting and it's because we didn't have a plan. So having a safety plan for parents, taking their ACE score, which is adverse childhood experience score, if it's four or more, talking to their doctor because they're at increased risk for mental illness, physical illness from unresolved trauma. If that score is six or more, they have a risk of a 20-year life expectancy reduction. For helping professionals administer the ACE score to your patients, ask if there's substances around your patients, mental illness in the home, violence in the home. And, you know, I feel like this will create awareness on the problem. This will help our families and our communities. And this is a piece of resilience. I mean, if you look at scientists who study good development versus what threatens good development, really there are protective factors such as effective education, schools, confidence, a nurturing adult, self-control. And so that's one of my roles then, because addiction undermines these protective factors to kind of help restore.
Well, I know that we want to thank you for opening a door that feels safe for our listeners. Where can our listeners get a copy of the book?
That's a great question. So they're actually signed copies at the Barnes & Noble on New Hope Commons. And you can find the book really anywhere in any bookstore, Amazon, Kindle, and the website as well, www.drjbattle.com.
Great. Well, we will definitely put a link up on that. And I just have to say thank you. Thank you for coming in. Thank you for your time.
And I have to say, you've come a long way, baby. I mean, that's just the thing that is so obvious here, is that you have made success where disaster was promising to suck you down, a lifestyle. And I'm so impressed and so glad to see that.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. Jameela Battle about her book, From Abuse to Abundance, and How to Address Trauma That Can Hold You Back. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Weither. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Bob and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And we are really fortunate because we also have Dr. Battle, who's agreed to stay with us as a fellow family physician. We're really excited by this. But first, we're going to have our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, read us our very first House Call question.
So our first question comes from someone who asks, do you ever recommend that your patients see a chiropractor? Why or why not?
And the answer is, I think laying on hands is a very important part of being a physician, and chiropractors exceed at that. Also, we have osteopaths that work in our practice with us, and they do so-called manipulation, which is in a lot of ways similar. So I have definitely referred people to chiropractors or osteopaths, probably more osteopaths because of the convenience of it, because I think they can help do body manipulation, and that helps people. I've certainly had to put my back into line a time or two.
Dr. Battle, I know you see a lot of patients in your sleep practice who probably have low back pain and joint problems from, you know, apnea and weight issues. You must get this question.
I do, and I recommend a chiropractor for actually non-opiate pain because also with addiction, I treat opiate addiction with Suboxone, and so pain can contribute to not only insomnia, but also overuse of opiate pain medication. So I often find that I'm referring in both practices to chiropractic medicine for non-opiate pain treatment.
You know, one of the things I'll say is, though, like a physician, you have to have the right physician for the right indication at the right time, sometimes for the right price. And a lot of times you ask, you know, who would you see? And I think the same thing goes for chiropractic. Not all physicians are equal. Not all chiropractics are equal. And a lot of times finding someone who really can do the indication, you know, back or the joints or something. But if something doesn't seem right, maybe manipulating a neck that doesn't feel safe, or if you're being asked to get x-rays that you don't agree with, you certainly have that right. But I think we're in general agreement. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm expecting my first child, and I also see a hairstylist about once every other month to get my hair color treated. Is it safe to continue to do so during pregnancy?
Well, now that's a good question. Who wants to go?
Well, I did look a little bit up, and there's not a lot of research to substantiate that. But hair color basically stays in the skin and hair, and it's not thought that much of it gets into the bloodstream. And so the general consensus of opinion, though not well studied, is that it's okay.
And I would imagine Bob and I haven't had children.
So from a personal standpoint, exactly,
yes.
I would say semi-permanent hair color would be safe to avoid permanent. And that's just based on kind of anecdote, not anything, no rigorous studies or any research there. Even postpartum, try to, you know, wait 3 months out just because hormones are, you know, declining and the hair shaft is pretty weak at that point or can be weak at that point. It's a lot of hair turnover and the color can further weaken the hair.
And I would often also really try to find out what exactly is going into the what chemicals are being used, and if you can use things that are natural pigments. These would be things that I would personally feel more comfortable with, and those are kind of common sense advices. You know, we'll ask our great health science librarians if they can actually put us up a link to things that don't involve perhaps chemicals that would be potentially toxic or things that could be avoided. Great.
Great.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
Is it really that bad to clean your ears with a Q-tip? I hear all the time that it's bad, but it feels like just basic hygiene.
It is a bad idea to clean ears with a Q-tip. Let me try to explain why. You manage, when you put a Q-tip in your auditory canal, that's your ear canal, to smear a little wax on the outside of it, and you think you're cleaning something. What you don't see is the stuff that you're pushing back against the eardrum. It's kind of like using a muzzle-loading cannon. And the trouble is you can either puncture your eardrum with a Q-tip, which is probably not very common, but more likely you can tamponade the tympanic membrane, your eardrum, so that you can't hear very well. I can't tell you how many people came into my practice and said, I'm really having trouble with this one ear. And we flushed it out and voila, they're hearing normally again. So that's definitely the wrong thing to do.
And I know that I've seen a number of folks who actually say that there's something wrong with their hearing. And I go look in their ear and I'm like, what am I really looking at? And, you know, after about 20 minutes, I realize I'm pulling out the end of a Q-tip that came dislodged in the ear. There's all kinds of things one can find in one's ear. You know, I think there are some people who safely, if they use it for gentle cleansing and certainly cleansing the outside of the ear, you know, can do okay. But there may be some natural things that one can also do. What did you learn, Dr. Battle?
So doing rinses, I've learned, is a natural, safe way to clean ears, or just kind of wiping on the outside of the ear. Really, the Q-tips can cause trauma, and I've seen that to the eardrum in training. So to avoid the Q-tips, as we've said, and doing like saline rinse or something like that would be a safer practice or way to clean your ears.
Yeah, and I read years ago, and I've been recommending it, and I'm waiting for that randomized controlled trial, of one or two drops of olive oil once a week as a preventive.
It may help it move out, because the hairs are supposed to sweep, but they can't when that stuff is further up the canal than the hairs tend to grow.
And it couldn't have been corn oil. It was definitely olive oil.
A handy thing that a lot of people can use if they want is just get yourself a water pick that you use your toothbrush with and just wash it out like that, and it'll come flying
exactly.
out.
Exactly.
But the point is, don't use water that's hot or cold, or you're going to get sick and vomit.
And dizzy.
Use water that's tepid. In other words, you can't feel the temperature difference when you put your hand in it.
We have time for one more house call. Laura?
My son has a peanut allergy, but my daughter absolutely loves peanut butter. Is there a way to keep them both safe and happy?
Well, we do have a mother of a couple of young kids sitting in this room. What would you say to that one, Dr. Battle?
How do you keep them happy?
I don't have peanut butter in the house because of this question. So we have non-peanut alternatives, and that's what we do to keep them happy.
You know, I think this is a great question. And, you know, one of the things you could do is certainly go visit an allergist, have your son tested, perhaps desensitized. What we have found is that exposing kids at younger ages than we've thought before to peanuts actually can help create children that don't have as many peanut allergies growing up. And on the other hand, if the child has very severe peanut allergies, you really have to probably create an environment free from that. So safety first. I think we might all agree that the safety of the child who has the severe allergy is first and foremost, and make sure the other child really knows so they're not trying to sneak those peanuts in. They could still go out and get their peanut butter ice cream or their peanut butter sandwiches at the cafeteria.
Yeah, just not the one that has the allergy.
Thank you to Dr. Battle. Thank you to Dr. Gwyther. Thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Your Health Today. We hope we summarize issues and concerns that are important to you, and you can send your questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or search Your Health, one word, for our health app. And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine and UNC Healthcare. And on behalf of all of us, we hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.